Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast number 52 for June 1st, 2010. This is our one-year anniversary podcast. I'm Dominic Rabi, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff
and David Liu.
We've got three great stories for you, as we always do. And our first story is the Twitter potentially allowing competitors to purchase trademarks as keywords for sponsored tweets. In other words, Microsoft, perhaps to boost Zune sales, could buy the iPod trademark, and then when people search for iPod, they'll get Microsoft's paid advertisements for the Zune on Twitter. This raises a couple issues, considering that we've seen similar circumstances with Google's AdWords. The Tiffany and eBay case comes to mind as one. This appears to be how Twitter is actually going to monetize its business. But do you think that there's going to be legal challenges based on this, considering that they're selling trademarks to people who don't own them to put advertisement for competitive products? It seems like this has been frowned upon in the AdWords lines of cases so far, and I don't see why Twitter would be any different.
It's been frowned upon in the AdWords cases? And if I'm not mistaken, in most, if not all of those cases, Google has won or they've settled. So Google's policy in these cases is that if somebody complains, they will Google will stop selling that trademark. So in this case, if somebody complained to Google about iPod being, if Apple complained about iPod being used as a keyword, Google would just stop selling that. And however, you know, from what I recall about those AdWords cases, in the vast majority of circuits. In the federal courts where they hear that, the courts have held that that's not a use in commerce. It's non-trademarked use because Google isn't selling a product; they're just selling a keyword. That it's not trademark violation. Google isn't. No one's. A better way to put that is that no one's at a risk of being confused by Google selling that term. You know, Microsoft isn't coming on and saying we want to buy the search term Google and then being confused that. I'm sorry, by the search term iPod. And then, you know, there's no risk that Microsoft, the consumer in that case, is being confused that they're purchasing an Apple product or that they're purchasing something from Apple. And that's really what trademark law is concerned about. If anyone would be liable, it would be Microsoft, who then purchases it and then uses that ad. That liability wouldn't fall on Google.
Sounds very reasonable. By frowned upon, I meant that it sort of gets legal challenges, not that it's necessarily against the law. Just that it sends Google into court. Like, I'm pretty sure Twitter will get sent into court.
Oh, absolutely.
This. Yeah, that's more what I meant.
But they're probably more motivated by the potential revenue that this could bring more than the potential slew of lawsuits that will come as a result of it. I mean, I don't see Twitter making that decision based on the possibility of frivolous lawsuits, more the possibility of actually having income.
Yeah, they do need to monetize the service somehow. So,
yeah. For what it's worth, they're calling these promoted tweets, and as a result of them starting up this promoted tweets program, they've shut down other services that do sponsored tweets, where an advertiser will buy time on somebody's Twitter account, usually a celebrity or minor celebrity of some kind. And, you know, there were services that had cropped up that were arranged around setting up these relationships between advertisers and Twitter users. I'm pretty sure those were just outlawed by the Twitter Terms of Service. So we won't be seeing any more of those, at least under the current Terms of Service.
Yeah, Twitter's definitely been doing interesting things with its market position lately. Like, they bought the Tweety, the popular Twitter iPhone client, and renamed it Twitter for the iPhone. And that gave them another platform for ads there. This embedded tweets functionality that they're rolling out, I think it's actually already been rolled out. Is that right? Or it's been in testing?
I'm not totally sure. So last I heard about it, it would only show up if you did a search on twitter.com for tweets, and I don't remember the last time I used search.twitter.com. I could probably do it right now and tell you, though.
Yeah.
For the sponsored tweets, did they actually include... So that was a special kind of tweet, and it wasn't just, hey, Technically Legal thinks that Microsoft brand lawsuits are awesome kind of thing, and just tweeting about that. It's actual, there's some sort of special form of tweet, right?
It's a promoted tweet, from what I understand. Like, it'll be marked as a promoted tweet. It it has to, it's not so much an ad as it is a tweet from someone who is actually, so basically it's not just like we're putting ads in here, we're putting tweets from people who buy, let me rephrase. The general idea from what I understand is that, say that you're Starbucks and you have a Twitter account and you are telling people how wonderful your Benti soy green tea frappuccino is, and you tweet this, and then you're like, you know what, Dunkin' Donuts, they're really moving into our competitive sphere, we're going to go on to Twitter and buy a promoted tweet and promote that tweet we just made, so that when people search about whatever we purchased in terms of the keywords, they're going to see results with that tweet in there as a promoted tweet. Twitter basically wants to make it so that these tweets are relevant to people. They say that they're trying to hold these to a higher bar in terms of they actually want people to be interested in seeing these tweets. And because they are actual tweets, they're going to not, I mean, they're not ads in that sense. They're showing up in the same sort of tweet streams that you see every day when you look at Twitter.
Right. I was actually asking about the sponsored tweets that they outlawed through the new latest terms of service. I don't remember what those were.
Oh, that would be like Kim Kardashian tweeting, check out this great new service that I found. But in reality, she may have never not known of that service. She just allowed like a Twitter API to hijack her account and do these sponsored tweets in return for her getting money.
Yeah, that wasn't an official Twitter service. I think that was a third-party thing.
That is correct. Right? Yeah, that's correct.
So are we still allowed to tweet about things that we like and get paid for it, or is that...
I think as long as you're not doing it through an API, it's fine. Okay. At the very least, I haven't seen anyone who's, you know, been... I haven't heard anything about people being, you know, reprimanded for doing that. I think the problem was that there were, you know, institutional ways of doing it that made it very easy and without any user input.
Yeah. And this promoted tweet platform that they're rolling out is interesting in that it's different than traditional advertising. I guess it is a little different than a Google AdWords cases, because with that you had people type in a keyword and they would see ads served up as ads. Where here you have people type in a keyword and you see tweets served up as tweets. And the interesting thing is Twitter says they're going to try to hold these to a higher bar, so that if people don't actually respond to the tweet, like by retweeting it or replying to it or favoriting it, then it'll fade away, so that ineffective tweets don't survive. So perhaps Microsoft launches a Zune campaign, buys out the iPod keyword, but no one pays attention to their promoted tweets. Twitter's new promoted tweet backend would basically make that disappear. And I mean, it still leaves them vulnerable to legal challenges, and there will doubtless be legal challenges, but it's certainly a little different than the AdWords situation.
Right. It makes you wonder how much people are going to pay for these. You know, is it going to be impressions, or do they pay a certain amount of money? And then, you know, if it doesn't get enough views because people don't like it, will it just fade away and, you know, they're out whatever money that they put into it initially? Be interesting to get a more in-depth business end view. I mean, I don't even know if Twitter's sure about how they're going to do all this yet.
Yeah, I think they're playing around with the feature to see how it goes, just because it is new. They're also trying to reposition Twitter as an information network as opposed to a social network, to try to distinguish themselves from Facebook. They want to basically... There's an interview that will link in their show notes with the general counsel at Twitter, who's basically saying that you don't really want to make that decision of, do I friend Starbucks? I mean, you want to get information from Starbucks, thus you follow them. And the whole vocabulary of friending, that's very much a social network thing, where Twitter is more sort of a information network that lets you just get information on the brands that you care about or the people that you care about, more so than just socially connecting with people. And this sort of fits into that, because promoted tweets are basically a way for those brands that you care about to sort of flag, if you will, or put a star next to tweets that they think are particularly interesting to you based on the keywords that they buy from Twitter. So it's a little gentler and nicer than your standard sort of advertising model, and it'll be interesting to see if it succeeds.
I mean, positioning it as an information network, you can then say, oh, these promoted tweets, they're not, you know, we're not giving them unfair positioning. We just think that this is the most relevant thing for you. It'd be like, you know, the first thing that you Google coming up.
Right.
You know, it's not a question of fairness. It's a question of, oh, we think this will be interesting to you. So it's an interesting way to position yourself so that you can justify doing this.
Yeah, Google, though, was always very careful to avoid selling search placement. They would let you put ads next to the search results, but they've never sold, like, all right, pay us this much money and you'll be the number one hit for this keyword. I think that's a little different than what Twitter's doing here, because they are putting the promoted tweets directly into the tweet stream. I understand that they're going to be marked as promoted tweets somehow, but I'm not entirely sure how they'll do that or if that's the case. I just kind of think that they are going to, but
yeah,
not sure if they will.
Well, Twitter's thing, for at least Twitter search, has never been, we're going to find you the most relevant thing to your search query. It's always just been, these are recent tweets that include your search query. So where Google's business is reliant on them giving you accurate information, Twitter's business is giving you current information. So I don't think, you know, putting those into the you know, tweet stream when you're looking at searches is going to be particularly invasive compared to what the same thing would do with Google.
No, that's very true. They've got slightly different positioning in terms of their search results. And search is something that's still pretty new at Twitter. Like, most people don't think of search when they think of Twitter. At least I don't think they do. So they're testing it out right now with Best Buy, Red Bull, Sony Pictures, Starbucks, Virgin America. Going to be testing out with a couple more people. More companies. And we'll see when the first lawsuit hits, and when it does, we'll certainly cover it. It'll be interesting to see how courts deal with it in terms of just understanding the technology behind Twitter. If judges haven't seen Twitter or don't use it, I would be very interested to see how the lawyers explain it to them in their briefs, because how do you explain Twitter? I know before I used the service, I was like, well, what is this thing for? And couldn't really find a good explanation for it. But when I used it, I was like, oh, that's how it works. So,
yeah, I agree. That being said, Twitter is so pervasive now, it's hard to believe that their judges don't have some exposure to it. I mean, when CNN and MSNBC and Fox News use Twitter and, you know, include things that people tweeted in, you know, newscasts, you know, there's going to be some base level of recognition that these judges have, hopefully.
That's true, but we've also seen judges without email, so, or without an understanding of how email or instant messages work. So
yeah, that's true.
There, right. I just checked, there is no official Supreme Court Twitter account, although there are a couple of people who do tweet specifically about Supreme Court decisions.
Is there anyone who's pretending to be one of the Supreme Court justices? Because that would be awesome.
Fake Justice Roberts.
Hold on, I'm going to register that right now.
Roberts or Scalia probably would be more entertaining to create a fake account for.
Yeah, it's true.
Roberts is too
restrained.
Too good at making people come together. All those qualities you need in a Supreme Court justice. Anyway, any last thoughts on this, David Liu?
I'm all set.
Ben?
I'm all set, and if you're all set, Dominic, I'll just take us on to the next story.
I'm all set.
Okay, so the next story is that Senator Schumer, a Democrat from New York, and Senator Cornyn, Republican from Texas, have announced a new bill that would require people who are buying disposable cell phones present an ID at the point of sale, and that the phone companies would be required to keep this information on file in order to help thwart drug dealers and to... terrorists, drug lords, and gang members is the quote from the bill. They also note that the occasional hedge fund manager has used a prepaid cell phone. My first issue with this is that there seems to be some, you know, while the Congress would have some ability to pass this law because it affects interstate commerce, there seems to be a First Amendment right in being able to purchase something, you know, especially something as basic as a phone, without having to produce some form of identification. You know, this is going to require the people who are buying it to produce identification, and it's, you know, essentially forced speech from a First Amendment view point of view on the part of the both me, who's, you know, if I'm buying the phone, having to provide certain information, and for both the phone companies who have to store that information, and the shop owners who have to act as an intermediary here. I mean, do we actually think that there's going to be any type of legal problem with this, or are people just going to kind of roll over and accept it?
I imagine people are going to roll over and accept it. I mean, I think a big part here is that cell phones do come under the FCC's jurisdiction, because the spectrum that cell phones use is regulated by the government, because there isn't an infinite amount of spectrum. It has to be parceled out. So and the cell phone industry falls under FCC regulation because of that, and there is no right to have a cell phone. I mean, there is a right to speech, but not necessarily one to speech using a cell phone. So, I mean, I can certainly see mandatory ID for everyone having a cell phone as a very real possibility in the near future, especially triggered by knee-jerk reactions like the failed Times Square bomber using anonymous prepaid cell phones, or countless television series using them as plot elements.
Yeah, it was a big plot element in, I know, The Wire, which is a great show that I think we've talked about in the past on the podcast. David Liu, I think, mentioned that this is a plot element on Law and Order a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, it's usually used as a plot element in the sense that it's a dead end. So they have to find more creative ways to find the criminals when they can't just look up where the cell phone calls were coming from. So in that sense, it will ruin a lot of potential SVU plots, just because now they have, you know, all phone calls could conceivably lead back to the identity of the person who purchased it, which I'm sure the SVU writers would find a way to get around, but it's still...
He used a fake ID, or they didn't, you know, write down the information or store it properly. Yeah, it doesn't seem like a particularly difficult thing to circumvent.
But the political nature of it is probably that the laws will pass and people will circumvent them.
Yeah,
but
you know,
it will be harder to circumvent them.
Sure.
As hard as me asking David Liu to go down and buy the burner for me. Burner is, by the way, slang for prepaid disposable cell phones, if you didn't know.
See, I thought it was for like CD-ROM writers.
But see, that assumes that I trust you, Ben. And...
I'll give you an extra $20 if you do it.
So first of all, do you guys think that this bill is going to make it through both houses of Congress and get signed by the president?
I mean, I'm not entirely sure where it is right now. I mean, whether or not it makes it, I don't think it's particularly controversial. I just wonder if, you know, people in the right committees care enough about it to get it to the floor in what's otherwise been a really kind of fraught legislative year with, you know, it seems like the only things that have been brought to pass are, you know, really big bills that are very close on the vote. You know, like I said, if people care about it, it'll get to the floor and it'll pass probably. But I don't know if anyone cares about it.
But, I mean, I think there's enough people who would wave the terrorism flag and the gang violence flag and the, you know, stockbrokers are evil flag and say, this is, you know, necessary for the security of all kind of thing. And I actually believe that, you know, it's probably a good idea, but I don't know.
It's really simple in the end. It just says if you're selling a cell phone that is a burner, then you have to get an ID and see an ID when you make that sale. And my personal, somewhat cynical view is that the bill will pass. It will be surprisingly ineffective because, oh, look, someone used a fake ID. All right, well, we're still at a dead end, guys.
Yeah, the other thing I should mention is that in order for this to get signed into law, somebody has to introduce the same bill or a similar bill in the House. And last I heard, no one had done that. So, you know, even if it does get to the floor and get a vote in the Senate, if no one introduces a similar bill in the House, it's, you know, dead in the water.
But in terms of a First Amendment issue. I don't think that there is one, just because of the FCC's regulatory purview over the cell phone market. Would you guys agree, or do you disagree?
I mean, this isn't a legal opinion, but we have the constitutional right to bear arms, but we still have ID for that, right?
Right.
So,
I mean, the interests in buying, so for one, the Second Amendment case law is kind of up in the air as to what restrictions the government can and cannot place on it. I don't think anyone's going to argue that background checks are okay because the state has an interest in keeping guns out of the hands of dangerous people, but, you know, and that interest is balanced against the dangerous people's right to have a weapon. I think the Supreme Court would find that, you know, a background check and keeping them out of the hands of felons is, you know, perfectly reasonable use of Congress's power.
On the international perspective, Canada actually studied this in 2006, and they saw that in 24 countries, 9 of them required this sort of identification before handing out prepaid phones. So,
was there any evidence that it was effective in preventing crime?
They didn't look into effectiveness, but their rationale was to improve the efficiency of law enforcement and national security activities.
That's fair.
I think there were also a number of state laws in various states, but this was, the senators were championing this as, you know, a federal effort to get it across the board, because obviously New York doesn't have it, and plenty of other states don't as well. I don't have that list in front of me of which states it is, though.
It looks like there are similar laws in Texas, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Georgia, and South Carolina, but that's obviously a small portion of the 50 states.
Before we move on to the next story, I want to sort of cover the privacy angle of this. Could you say, could someone argue that the constitutional right to privacy should prevent people from being forced to give an ID when they purchase a prepaid cell phone? Say that I'm a privacy advocate and I'm like, you know, I just want to have a phone that no one knows that it's mine unless I give them the number. I don't want the government listening in and having information that can trace that call to me.
I mean, right now, the scope of constitutional right to privacy has been so circumscribed. You know, there was a heyday where it was, you know, getting broader by the minute, and now it's been relegated to something called substantive due process, where essentially the Supreme Court will only find that you've got a right to privacy in this if, you know, the right of privacy has been long established in the United States history, and, you know, it's fundamental to our way of living. So they've essentially cut off any new rights to privacy for the court to find. So I don't find that availing. If they're going to do it, they're going to have to try to wedge this into a First Amendment free speech type of argument.
That is probably the best argument against this, though, is that, I mean, that is one of the few valid ways that I could see prepaid cell phones being used.
For anonymous speech, like let's say a source wants to divulge information but doesn't want to be traced back?
Or even just people who want that freedom regardless of what they're actually doing.
Because they have something to hide, as various anti-privacy advocates may have said at one time or another. Although they obviously don't necessarily have anything to hide, but the act of wanting privacy has garnered greater suspicion in our modern society. What about alternatives? Like, instead of an identification at point of sale, why not just have some sort of identification with the carrier when the phone gets activated? Like, would that run into First Amendment issues?
I mean, it would have the same problem that this one had, but I mean, I'm just not sure how it would be easier or better to enforce it at the carrier level than it would at the purchase level.
I mean, it's still open to the, oh, my dog actually was the one who authorized the, or who activated the phone.
Yeah, I mean, at least if you're doing it at the store level, the person can look at the identification and see if you look like, you know,
your identification.
Right.
Yeah, and then the problem is, how if you do it when you activate, are you just going to, like, scan a picture of your license with your phone somehow?
Yeah, and
I mean, it's the question of how you get your ID to the carrier. You and the sensible way would be to do it when you get the phone.
Yeah,
So
I
I don't
imagine
know.
that over the phone would be some sort of digital system, not necessarily with the photo ID, but with other forms of identification, like perhaps their full social security number or some other form of ID or your driver's license number. So in any case, we will keep our eye on this story. And Ben or Dave, do you have any?
I'm all set.
My last final thought is, in researching this, I learned that what most people have is called a postpaid phone. Just so you know.
What is a postpaid phone?
It's a phone where you use it, and then after you use it, you have to pay. So instead of prepaid,
a normal
it's
cell
postpaid.
Phone. Okay.
Yes.
All right. And take us away to our last story, David.
So our last story involves the Apple's App Store and a Go application that was released through the App Store that was originally released under the new license. And it was actually released under GPL version 2. And the core of this is that the new license says you cannot restrict certain uses of this code. And we'll get more into what that actually means. And however, in the Apple terms of use or the App Store terms of service, they restrict how you can actually use it. So I think the best way to illustrate this is to actually dive into the language of these two terms of service. So, or actually of the GPL. So yeah, let's start with GPL version 2. In section 6 of that document, it says, quote, each time you redistribute the program or any work based on the program, the recipient automatically receives a license from the original licensor to copy, distribute, or modify the program subject to these terms and conditions. And then here's the important part. It says, you may not impose any further restrictions on the recipient's exercise of the rights granted therein. And so this is what some people call copyleft. It's kind of the opposite of copyright, but it restricts what you can do with this work. So it restricts how you can redistribute it. Does that make sense? Have you guys ever heard that term before?
Copyleft? Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it does put restrictions on how you may redistribute the work, but essentially all of the restrictions are that you can't redistribute the work in a way that is more restrictive than it's already been distributed to you. So in that sense, it's not very the restrictions are not very restrictive.
Right. And then going into the App Store terms of service, in where the apps are called products, and this is section 9B, it says, you acknowledge that products contain security technology that limits your usage of products to the following applicable usage rules, and whether or not products are limited by security technology, you agree to use products in compliance with the applicable usage rules, end quote. And so what has happened is that the Free Software Foundation is, they're not pursuing any particular legal action against this, but they brought up the fact that the terms that the App Store applied to this game of Go were against what the GPL said. And the end result of this, cutting to the punchline, is that predictably, Apple has removed this game and app from the App Store.
And the Free Software Foundation was disappointed that Apple didn't change their terms. So.
Yeah, a quote is, unfortunately, instead of amending their terms of service to work with the new GPL, Apple have decided to remove New Go from the App Store. Please read our follow-up report. I am shocked. Shocked!
Shocked. I know. Yes, the software was violating the GPL, and Apple did the right thing by removing it. I mean, it'd be unlikely for them to amend their terms to permit GPL software just because amending their terms might have other consequences that they don't like. Whereas keeping these restrictive terms in terms of what you can do through the App Store allows Apple to leverage its competitive advantage in having an App Store for its own maximum benefit in the competitive marketplace.
Yeah, among other things, Apple would probably have some sort of duty to ensure that apps that were licensed under the GPL didn't have any DRM on them, and that the source code of those was available for people to download and modify at will. And you know, even the apps, even the developer program. So if I were to download this code and modify it, I wouldn't be able to load it onto my device without first joining the iPhone developer program, which costs $100. So even that would probably violate the
GPL. That's actually
incorrect,
Ben. You can download the SDK without paying $100. The $100 is to get listed in the App Store.
I thought that also. I thought you weren't allowed to load. You can load applications now onto your phone without paying the fee?
As far as I understand, yes. I may be incorrect at that, but I know I've joined as an iPhone developer without paying any money, although I haven't actually tried loading it onto my phone because I don't have a Mac.
Okay. So.
But my understanding was the $99 is for actually getting listed in the App Store, not for developing.
Yeah, and for getting betas of SDKs.
And perhaps for betas, but not for the live SDK.
Right. So. I can download the current, whatever it is, 3.1.2 SDK without joining up, without, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Well, that aside. David,
so
anywhere else? Or go ahead.
Yep. Yeah. This could have gone two ways. Obviously, the Free Software Foundation wanted it to go one way, and Apple decided to go a different way. It should be worth noting that the Free Software Foundation also contacted the people who actually developed this application for the App Store. But what would the consequences have been if they had gone the other way and amended the App Store terms of service to, you know, possibly allow GPL'd software?
I think, as Ben already hinted, it would result in a pretty massive headache for Apple, because if they amended their terms, I imagine the Free Software Foundation and other free software advocates would keep a careful eye on what sort of free GPL'd software is on the App Store. And if, as soon as something wasn't perfectly in compliance with the GPL license, they would come complaining to Apple and ask that it would get fixed. So Apple probably spared itself a pretty big headache by just getting rid of the software and showing that it wasn't going to change its rules, because had it, I mean, every single, the way the App Store is set up with Apple as the gatekeeper, basically it would have required their time and their analysis each time that an app was even accused of violating the GPL. And that's not something Apple wants to get into, because they don't necessarily have the people there or the time to really look at whether an app is complying with the GPL, and that's not what they view their App Store as. That's not what they view the App Store for.
Right. Another interesting question is, would the Free Software Foundation have been able to legally compel Apple to change their change the App Store to be compliant with the GPL? And you know, my feeling on that is probably not, as Apple wasn't party to the license or the contract. So there are two parts of this. There's, you know, in this license, you can view it as either just a simple license to use, you know, the software, and if you violate the license, you're liable, subject to a suit for copyright infringement or breach of contract, you know, because there's two parties, there are promises on both sides, and, you know, there's agreement. I don't think Apple would have been liable particularly under either theory, because there's, you know, no evidence here that Apple assented to the license or was even party to, you know, the license or contract.
That makes sense. David Liu, anything else you want us to discuss on this story?
No, I think we're good.
Ben, any final comments?
Nope, I'm all set.
Thank you all for listening. This has been Technically Legal Episode 52, our fabulous one-year anniversary. I have been David Liu.
I'm Dominic Ribe.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
Please check out our blog at technicallylegal.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at TechLegal, and please leave us your comments or suggestions for stories. And thank you very much. And here's to another great year of Technically Legal.